Hey, I'm Eric Thornburg, and welcome to another episode of Maker Stories, where we explore what makes the makers, what drives them, what they're scared of, how they make sense of the world, and everything in between. This week's episode is with Cal Newport. Cal is a computer scientist, a professor, and author of 5 books. In this episode, we explore his book, Get So Good They Can't Ignore You, which talks about the importance of mastery and the follies of blindly pursuing your passion. And I selfishly ask Cal how these principles apply to my life and how he recommends I get better at the skills I'm passionate about, like entrepreneurship, writing, rapping, and podcasting. Then we talk about his new book, Deep Work, which comes out today, January 5th, and which I highly recommend you purchase, which explores the concept of deliberate practice and how to construct a life where you can consistently incorporate deliberate practice into your life. This is a great episode. Cal has a lot of fantastic thoughts, and I'm excited to hear what you think. Check it out, and check out his book, Deep Work. So good they can't ignore you. It's been very popular advice the last, you know, however long, to follow your passion. But so good says that that's kind of, can be misleading advice sometimes. Elaborate a little bit, Cal.
Yeah, I think telling someone to follow their passion can actually reduce the probability that they end up passionate about their work. So when I say follow your passion is bad advice, I'm not saying that passion is bad, and I'm not saying that you shouldn't try to be passionate about your work. What I'm arguing in this book, and more generally speaking, is that the specific strategy of identifying a pre-existing passion and then following that pre-existing passion to find your career is a specific strategy that does not work well if your goal is to end up with fulfilling, meaningful work.
And So Good came out in, a couple years ago?
Yeah, it was the fall of 2012.
How has it been perceived since?
It's been interesting. The first thing I've noticed is that the sales never slowed down. Right. So it just, after, of course, the initial, you know, month publicity push, it never slowed down sales. People keep passing this book on to other friends. They keep telling people about it. And it's you look at quarter to quarter, not much is changing. So I think it's out there percolating under the radar. And I basically get two responses to it. Either I get a very positive response, someone saying, finally, there's a more applicable discussion, a more sophisticated discussion about these things I really care about. I don't just want slogans. Like, I really want to build a career that is meaningful to me, and I need a more sophisticated way of thinking about that than just you're wired to do one thing, figure it out. The other type of response I get is really negative. And almost always that response comes from this idea that to follow your passion is the only way to end up passionate about your work. And that if you say don't follow your passion, then I must be saying be satisfied with mediocre work, be satisfied with a mediocre life. And I'm saying the exact opposite, but I can't blame people for having that misperception because we are so inculcated with this idea that follow your passion equals the only path to work that you love.
It has a nice marketing ring to it. It's a lot
easier to see. Great pitch.
And then, of course, the Steve Jobs video, which as you describe in your blog, Study Hacks, was incorrectly interpreted.
It was. So he did say, do what you love, and if you haven't found it yet, keep looking. But it's clear from various sources, including biographical sources and interviews with Jobs and interviews with people who knew Jobs well, information that I've sort of collated over many years, that he did not mean you are wired to do one thing, figure out what that is, and then go pursue it. That's not at all what he meant. What he really meant was you need to create a working life you love. This is a complicated process, but it's one that's worth sticking with.
All right, so let's break down these terms a little bit. So meaningful career, first, you've written that it involves, and feel free to jump in, autonomy, creativity, mastery. How do you define a meaningful career?
Right. So if we think about people who are find meaning in their work or feel what the social psychologist would probably call career satisfaction, so they're satisfied with their work in life, it's a source of meaning and satisfaction in their life. What we find if we look at the data is that matching the work to a pre-existing interest is not that important. We don't have a lot of data that says what separates people who are satisfied by their work from people who are not is that the satisfied people match their work to a pre-existing interest. We just don't see that in the data. What we do see is that the people who love their work tend to have the following elements, like you just said: a sense of autonomy in what they do, a sense of mastery, they're very good at something, a sense of impact on the world, a sense of connection to other people, a sense of creativity in their work. These type of traits, which are not tied to a specific job or tied to a specific passion, these type of traits tend to be the magic elixir for career satisfaction. So really the more sophisticated take on doing what you love is it's not about there being some magic right job out there for you to discover. It's instead about how do I shape and evolve my career over time so that I have these traits like autonomy, mastery, impact, and relationships that the research says will certainly lead to real satisfaction.
And rephrasing those, you know, autonomy in the sense that you get to choose what, you know, you have a lot of freedom in your work, mastery that you get, you know, very good at it, if not become a master, impact that you think what you're doing is fundamentally good for the world, or, you know, equally important that you don't think what you're doing is bad for the world, which, you know, sometimes happens in some jobs. And you actually had this one post that was something like, you should leave your job if these three things are met. Do you remember that post?
Yeah, so I call these the disqualifiers for a career that could generate passion. Because what I'm saying, in essence, is there's no one right job for you. So there's a lot of jobs that could lead to passion, but that doesn't mean that every job can lead to passion. So there's a couple things that we know are clear disqualifiers that'll make it almost impossible for you to transform that career path into passion. And those include if the work itself is antithetical to your own sense of values, you're going to have a hard time feeling passion, you know, for that work. If the people are bad or a bad fit for you, if you have a boss who is vindictive or mean or an a-hole, if you don't like the other people you work with, we just know that you're almost, there's nothing else you can do. You're not going to like that job. And the third thing is if the job does not actually give you room for growth and flexibility. So if the job does not give you more options and more control as you get better, if it instead fits you into a very fixed path that's very hard to deviate from, that also makes it hard for you to potentially build a real sense of passion for your work. So I call those three things misaligned with your values, you don't like the people, doesn't give you much control as you get better. Those are disqualifiers. If a job has any of those three, you're going to have a hard time building passion. But if the job does not match any of those disqualifiers, and tons of jobs don't, it is a candidate for building a career you love. So I'm really taking the pressure off of this choice of what you do and putting a lot of pressure on what happens once you've made the choice.
Yeah, I've been using that metaphor just in life in general, you know, in terms of relationships or friendships, or, you know, what you pick does matter, but not as much as what you do once you make that decision.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. You can't throw darts at a career guide and say, this is the job I'm going to do. But on the other hand, if you're expecting that if you find the right job, that you're going to feel this epiphany from day one that'll never go away, that's a recipe for disappointment.
I remember a few years ago when I graduated college, I emailed you and said, hey, I have these two great opportunities. I'm sure you get emails like this all the time. I was like, one, I got to Teach for America and I have an interest in education. And another, I got some funding for this business idea. And that's what you answered with. It doesn't matter which one you do. Both will, you know, lead to opportunities for autonomy and mastery and set yourself up for a good place. And I hear you on that.
Yeah, it's a subtle distinction, but it really can save people from a lot of grief. This is why I say follow your passion can actually make people less passionate, because it puts you in this mindset of there is one thing I'm meant to do. So that you're out there scanning, how do I feel, what's going on every day, to say, is this really something I feel passionate about? And you're in this introspective mode where any job is going to fall short, especially in the first few years where you're at the entry level and you haven't built up enough autonomy yet, you don't have a sense of mastery yet. So now you become introspective and start thinking, well, maybe this is not my passion. Then you switch jobs and then you say, well, this is not my passion. You're jumping around, you don't know what you want to do, and you're unhappy. That's a way worse off situation to be than if you had just stuck with the first thing and said, how do I build this into something that I'm going to find meaningful?
Right. Another thing you mentioned when you talked about meaningful career was relationships. You know, and I've seen a lot of people, you know, whether it's professors or I don't know, different types of people who have really benefited from kind of, or loved the fact that they built these relationships over time, over even generations sometimes. How do you think about that?
Yeah, we're wired, right? We're wired to be social creatures. So an important part of job satisfaction that we don't think about much because it's completely orthogonal to the actual type of work, is that if your job allows you to connect to people and build deep relationships and feel like you're a part of something, you're going to get way more satisfaction out of it. And this has nothing to do with pre-existing passion, but it's incredibly important and something that if you work at, you can actually get more benefit from than if you don't.
Does that lend an argument that people should maybe perhaps stay at their jobs longer than a year or 2 years, or that there is something to be said about being in someplace for a while? Or
I think so. I think when you're evaluating job options, especially when you're, say, fresh out of college, what you're really looking at is what the job could be in 5 years, right? So don't get caught up with what am I going to be doing in my first month if I take this job. The right question to ask is, if I take this job and if I focus like a laser on getting really good at the skills that are really valuable in this field, if I do that for 5 years, what would my job look like? What would be open to me? And that's really the job you want to be thinking about when you're making a decision.
Cool. And we'll get on that in a bit. And I want to bring up our mutual friend, Ben Casnoca. But first, let's define the next term. Getting so good. What does getting so good mean? And what are the main principles under that? You know, I'm talking about deliberate practice, shutting out distractions. Elaborate on those things.
The actual quote, "Be so good they can't ignore you," from which I took the book title, is a Steve Martin quote. And that was his advice to aspiring young entertainers. He talked about this on the Charlie Rose Show. And he said they don't like this answer. What they want to hear is, you know, here's the hack, or here's the secret system to getting an agent, or if you really want, you know, to get cast on a show, you need to focus on this. He said, no, my advice is much more simple. Be so good they can't ignore you, and good things will come. And I took that phrase as the core of my book. And let me explain the connection here. So we said before that the traits that make work meaningful are things like autonomy, mastery, impact, creativity, relationships. So this begs a question. How do you cultivate those type of traits in your job? Forget what the job is, just in any job, how do you cultivate those type of traits? And the big idea of my book was you have to think about this in economic terms. Those traits are valuable. Right? They make your life better. They're hard to get. They're not just being handed out. You can't just wander into an entry-level job and say, I want full autonomy and feel like I'm really masterful at my work. Right? They're very rare and valuable. So you have to have something to offer in return. So the basic formula that I pitch, my alternative to follow your passion, is if you want those traits, you need to offer something in return. And what you can offer in return is rare and valuable skills. So the action item you need to do is choose a few things that are unambiguously valuable in your field and work on deliberately improving those skills. Become so good at those skills you can't be ignored, and then use that as your leverage, as your bartering chip, to get more autonomy in your work, to get more sense of mastery in your work, to get more sense of impact in your work. You become so good they can't ignore you, and then invest that to acquire the type of traits in your job you want.
And to break that down even further, let's just say, you know, like Steve Martin, someone wanted to be a great comedian. You know, you give a lot of tips on how to get so good they can't ignore you, which is this concept of deliberate practice. Talk a bit about that.
Yeah, deliberate practice is how people get better at cognitively demanding skills. And what it is in a nutshell is activities that are designed to stretch your current level of ability. So let's say, for example, you want to get better at computer programming. What we know now from 3 or 4 decades of research in performance psychology is that if, for example, you just maybe read a lot about computer programming, that's not going to make you much better. Similarly, if all you do is just program a lot, that's also not going to make you much better. If you really want to improve quickly, what you have to do is say, well, where is my skill lacking? What type of exercise could I do that would push myself and force me to improve and stretch that particular skill? Maybe you're doing object-oriented programming and you're really rusty, you don't really understand polymorphism. So you would say, what I'm going to do here is I'm going to actually give myself some sort of programming challenge in which I'm going to really have to figure this out or it's not going to work. And that deliberate stretch of your ability is what makes you better. So I spent time, for example, in researching So Good with a professional guitar player and watching the way he practiced. And the reason I was with a professional guitar player is that I had played guitar for many years when I was younger. And I looked at this guy and said, after he'd been playing guitar for the same number of years I did, he was a professional recording musician, well-respected. And I was just kind of a middling amateur player. What's the difference? We both played a lot. And so I watched how he practiced. And I said, that's the key. He was doing deliberate practice. He would find where he was weak on his licks, and he would push himself deliberately to go a little bit faster than he was comfortable, to keep pushing his skills. So that's the mindset you have to have in your own career. When you find a skill that is very valuable, you have to think about improving it like a professional athlete or a professional musician or a professional chess player. What is my systematic, deliberate practice plan for improving the skill? That's the fastest way to improve a skill. And almost no one is doing this in the knowledge work sector. So if you do, you're going to get phenomenal results relative to the other people in, say, your company or field.
Give an example of that taking place in the knowledge work sector.
Right. So for example, if you wanted to improve, like I want to be a better programmer, right? You're doing some, say, low-level development. You went to a boot camp, you're doing Ruby programming or something like this, and you say, okay, I want to move up to the next level. You could get there really quickly if you find deliberate exercises, say, to master C++ or something like that, where you say, okay, I don't really understand this, but I have a textbook here, and I have an exercise right here, and okay, I got to get this thing done. I got to figure this out, and until I can do this exercise and I can actually answer this problem. Okay, so that's going to stretch you, and you're going to get a little bit better. And then you say, okay, well, let me take on a bigger exercise. And then after you have some basics, you might say, I'm going to take on a project in C++, and I'm missing about 30% of the skills I need to actually get this done, but they're going to be expecting results. And now that's going to really stretch you over a couple-week period, the cram, and figure that out. Those type of activities are deliberate practice activities. It's not unlike a professional athlete doing carefully calibrated calisthenics to improve a certain muscle or a certain type of lung capability. You're deliberately stretching yourself, and you get better fast.
And whatever, I love this concept in whatever field. In some ways, it's much clearer, like chess, for example. In other ways, it isn't. But the concept basically, you do the thing that matters to get better, and almost everything else is way secondary. And we're way focused on our Twitter handle, our Twitter feeds, and like personal branding before we're even good. I don't know.
Yeah, I agree with that. You got to simplify all of this, right? One or two skills that are unambiguously valuable in your field, and then you need to spend more time trying to get better at those systematically than other people are doing. And that's all that matters, right? It doesn't matter that you're tending your Twitter feed well. It doesn't matter that your Facebook groups are well tended. If you do that, if you become so good you can't be ignored, as Steve Martin said, good things will come.
And there are examples of people who have just focused on so good you can't ignore and don't even do the Twitter or the Facebook or any of the other stuff, and people just can't. Who are some examples that come to mind for you?
Well, myself. So I frustrate people because I've never had a Facebook account, I've never had a Twitter account, I don't know what a Snapchat is, I don't web surf. I mean, I don't know how to web surf. You put me in front of a browser and say, entertain yourself, I don't know what site to go to. Like, what sites do you go to entertain yourself? I'm a blogger who doesn't read blogs. That's because a long time ago, I made the decision that there's two things I want to do really well. I want to write really well, and I want to solve. I'm a computer scientist by trade, and I want to solve proofs well. I'm a theoretical computer scientist. And I just pour my energy into those two things, deliberately trying to stretch my ability. And it turns out that you don't actually have to be really involved in social media to succeed in these fields. You don't have to be good at email. I'm bad at email. I'll go days without checking it. It doesn't really matter. I mean, ultimately what the market cares about is, well, what can you do that is really well, that is really valuable? So I'm actually a big advocate of way simplifying. I mean, unless your job really depends on things like connections or sort of social media visibility. I mean, if you're in some sort of marketing or communications role, that's a different thing. But I think for most people, radically simplifying what's on your plate so that you can deliberately improve the one or two skills that matter most is a recipe that is way more likely to lead you to not just a very successful, but a very meaningful career.
And how have you thought about that with your writing? Like, have you thought about the deliberate practice with writing?
I mean, this has been my whole writing career. So, after my first two books were in a pure how-to format, for example. And I said, okay, my goal is I want to have a hardcover general idea book, nonfiction book at the front table at Barnes & Noble. Well, I couldn't do that then. I wasn't a good enough writer. I wasn't in the right place to do it. I wrote those first books in my young 20s. I didn't have the stature to do that. So I set out trying to deliberately improve my ability to do idea book style writing. And I actually gave myself exercises like an athlete would in training. For example, one of the things I did after my second book is I found a magazine, an online magazine, that had a competitive submission process, right? You could pitch articles to them, but if they didn't really like it, they weren't going to accept it. And then it was going to be edited pretty fiercely. once you actually submitted it. And the style of articles in this magazine was the style of writing I wanted to do. So I said, I'm just going to keep deliberately trying to get articles accepted at this magazine and then write them as good as possible. I want to get the best feedback possible from the editor. And doing this over 4 or 5 articles vastly improved my writing ability in a period of about 6 months.
And what does deliberate practice look like for people who want to be entrepreneurs or who want to start businesses?
Yeah, that's actually a good question. I don't necessarily have a good answer for this. I mean, this is something that I've talked to with other entrepreneurs. I've talked to, you know, our friend Ben, for example, Ben Casnoka. We talk about this a lot. It seems to depend on what type of business you're doing and what scale and where you are in the business, right? I mean, for an entrepreneur, the skill you need to do really more valuable than anything else for some businesses might be customer acquisition. And really everything else comes from that. You know, if you're doing a network effect style consumer facing internet play, for example, if you can gather lots of users and consumers, that might be the absolute most important thing, and everything else will go easier. You'll make fundraising easier, you'll make recruiting easier, everything else easier. So that you could maniacally focus on that. But if you're doing, say, like a back-end enterprise play or this or that, I mean, it really might just be the quality of the engineering is everything, and that you and your team is just pushing for this, the very best possible engineering. So I think it really depends on the play, but I think the mindset's important. But more importantly, I think it's important from a managing point of view too, because if you're running a business, you can push your employees towards this direction. Like, I want you as an employee of this startup to identify what's the most valuable thing you could be doing for us, and then tell us how can we get out of your way so you can do that. And that might mean, for example, don't expect me to answer emails, don't bother me, whatever it is, I don't want to go to meetings. Like, you got to let me do, if this is what's valuable, then give me the room I need to do it, and then hold me accountable. But I think, you know, it's not just what the founder can do, it's the environment that he can set up for his people.
Yeah, and when I, you know, found your blog when I was in college, Jesus, it was just such a wake-up call. No matter what I was doing, it's like, do the thing that matters, don't do everything else, no meetings, no check-ins, like, only, you know, and no one else is living this way. No one else most people aren't, you know, really effectively using their time to get better. We're almost allergic to it. It's hard.
It's very hard. And as I get farther along in my careers, the main reality I'm noticing is that everything is harder than you think. As you move to more higher and higher levels in a field, things get cooler. Your life gets cooler. The work gets more interesting, more satisfying. But each next level gets just infinitely more difficult than the last. I mean, this is the view from like halfway up the ladder. That's the view. I don't know what it's like at the top of the ladder, but I can tell you the view from halfway up the ladder is it gets way harder than at the bottom. So you need to start off with, you know, your game face on and be blowing through those early rungs. You know, no one made a fortune being really good at using Facebook, but there's some people who made a lot of money being good enough at, say, engineering to design Facebook. And I think that's the right way to think about it.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I say that point to also say that, you know, Ben is also someone I was influenced by in college. And you guys, you interesting theories, because your philosophy, get so good you can't ignore you, deliberate practice. Well, Ben has developed this concept of kind of pursuing serendipity and being open to a lot of opportunities. And he might say that, you know, social media has been important for him, used wisely, of course, has been important for him to locate opportunities he may not have located otherwise. Where did these two philosophies, you know, pursuing serendipity and, you know, shutting up and deliberate practicing, where do they overlap, and where are they different?
Well, Ben, I've known Ben forever. We've argued about this forever. He's been a promoter of serendipity through exposure, and I've gone back and forth on it. So he actually gets more credit because he's been very stable in his point of view, which is exposing yourself. He used to call it bulk positive randomness. Exposing yourself to serendipitous things is good. He's always thought that. I've gone back and forth, and now where I'm falling, so, you know, I think he has a stronger position here, is that it depends where you are, right? So if, for example, you're still in college and still not even sure what type of things you might try to pursue, exposing yourselves to a lot of things is valuable, right? Because you might end up, you know, learning about a whole field that you didn't know about, but that's a good fit for some skills you've already built, or meet someone that leads to something very powerful. On the other hand, once you're locked in, my belief is once you're locked in at building a skill, you're in an industry, there's a clear valuable skill and you're building it. My experience, and I've written about this recently, is that At that point, shipping things that are valuable generates serendipity. So once you're actually a writer who's written a couple books or something, or once you're a grad student training to be an academic, I mean, the most important thing you can do is ship things that are valuable. And in my experience, that brings to you, that attracts to you, lots of interesting opportunities. You don't go out there and do a lot of tweets and hope that maybe you'll stumble across someone. The interesting stuff will be targeted towards you once you get out there and start shipping things. So that's where I fall now. Serendipity is important, but how you actually attract it really is different depending on where you are in your career.
And you know, one thing you also did a course on deliberate practice where you had a bunch of people enter. And tell us about the results from that, because one thing I got from the book, I loved it, but I wanted just a little bit more examples. And I know, you know, it's early science, relatively, so there weren't a ton. What have you learned from that course?
Yeah, it's been very interesting. So I've been working on this with Scott Young, who's a fellow writer and blogger. And we're trying to develop a course about how to apply deliberate practice in your knowledge work job to get good real quick. So what we've done is, so far we've run two pilot versions of the course, which were exploratory, right? We were getting tons of feedback, small groups of people, lots of interaction, and they've been very informative. And we're actually now designing the final full version of the course, which, you know, should be available in the fall. So keep your eyes open for that. But you know what we found that was interesting in doing this course and working with hundreds of people on this problem is that figuring out what skill to improve is a huge roadblock and is way more complicated than people might assume. That, you know, maybe 30% of people is just obvious. In my field, this is the skill to get good at. For the other 70% of the people, that's actually where the bulk of the effort had to go. Is one, figuring out what actually is valuable in this line of work is not an obvious question. And once they had that answer and had that clarity, the rest was almost easy. So I think for a lot of people, you have to expect that you might need to spend a lot of time trying to understand what really matters here. It's not always obvious.
Can you give an example of one person in the class?
Yeah. So I have to be careful not to break anonymity. But so we had a musician in the class, for example, I can say that. So he's a songwriter, a recording artist. And it took him a while to figure out, okay, that what was important was the qualities of the song he was writing, and that the type of exercise he needed to do was spend a lot more time basically forcing a song idea through to a completed recorded song, recorded with his own equipment. But by forcing yourself to take an idea and produce the best song that he could with it was a stretch activity. And his problem before is that oftentimes once he'd get started on a song, he would notice early on, like, I don't think this is going to be a hit, like a great song. So he would abort. I want to wait for the great song. And what he discovered working on it in the course was that, yeah, but pushing through and getting the best thing you can, that's like running as fast as you can in a training day, even when you're not feeling your best. You're stretching muscles and you're getting better. So it took him a while to figure out that that's the discipline he needed to be doing. He needed to be at a regular rate taking ideas and finishing songs and doing it from a weightlifting metaphor point of view, not from a, hey, what's my next big song going to be type of view.
Yeah. And one of the things you always talk about is kind of rigorous focus. You don't want to pick too many things. But my question is, you know, and I'll preface it with the Steve Martin quote that something along the lines of when someone asked him about if he's going to pick up the banjo, he's like, I'm only going to do it if I can dedicate 20 years to it. Because, you know, that's how long it might take to become a master. How many things do you think about? You know, right now you're doing two things, but do you think you'll think about other things to pick up that you might want to be a master at? Or how does one think about it over a lifetime?
Yeah, you have to think about sort of big granularity and small granularity. So at the big granularity, this is things like writing or being a theoretical computer scientist. Two is basically the max, right? I mean, you can take two things and spend 20 years on them. And you need probably about 20 years to get to the highest, you know, level of mastery. And so one or two is probably where you can't do four. That sounds restrictive, but on the small granularity, within each of those broad categories, as you build mastery, there's going to be a lot of smaller directions that you can explore, a lot of sort of sub-mastery that happens within it. So there's this notion of you're very diligently focused at the big level of granularity. You know, I'm a writer and I'm a computer scientist, so I don't want to spend any time, you know, doing videos or whatever, or I don't want to get too involved in speaking. That's a different thing, and I only have my two big things. But within each of those things, you might actually, over the years, have a lot of different related directions to explore. So that's where your sense of diversity and serendipity and exploration happens, within a very steady, larger granularity point of focus.
It's interesting. You also identify in the book between kind of winner-take-all markets, where it's literally just be the best of the thing. And what's the other term?
Auction market.
Where it's a combination of kind of rising up, or what's that?
Yeah, if you're trying to think about what skill I should improve, this metaphor seem to be helpful, that there's some type of jobs where it's incredibly clear what the skill is. So my example in the book, for example, was a television writer. There's no ambiguity about what skill is important there. How good are your scripts? That's everything. And the person who writes the best scripts gets the jobs. And if you're like a little bit below that cutoff, you get no jobs. It's a winner-take-all market. So those markets are very difficult. But they're also psychologically pretty easy, because you know exactly what you need to work on. And so there's no confusion. The other type of market's more complicated, and that's what I call the auction market. And that's where you build up maybe a couple disparate skills, related but disparate skills, and get very good at them. And there's not necessarily a well-known path for that particular combination. So you go shopping and try to find someone who is going to highly value you, because you're one of the only people in the world that happens to be good at those three or four related things. So my example there was of a Stanford grad who was good. He had built a skill in entrepreneurship and had built a real skill in green technology and the research around the green technology, which made him a perfect fit for a green technology venture capital firm, which is where he works today. So it's just two different ways to think about skill development. It depends on what you're trying to do.
Yeah, it's like a combination of skills and where your comparative advantage, as long as they're unambiguously valuable. Would you put Ben Casanova in that category?
Yeah, I think he's probably in the auction market category, because you know he'll take something and work on it and do it really well, and then sort of step back and say, okay, so to whom is this interesting or valuable? And that has led him to some sort of really interesting, really successful places.
Yeah, and I'm thinking about this theory kind of out loud, but the way I've thought about it is kind of think about it in terms of platforms, in a sense. So I know that, and maybe I'm just choosing too many here, I'd love to hear your feedback, but I know that I want to be really good at writing. I'm doing that for a while. I know that I want to be really good at rapping. I'm doing that for a while. I know that I want to be really good at, and I know I want to be really good at interviewing people. And so, fortunately, you know, I started, the first company was a music technology company that allowed me to rap with some of the best people very frequently. So it allowed me to get really good, allowed me to do it, you know, what I care about. And this product hunt allows me to interview a lot of people who are really great. And then, but I'm curious, this concept of, like, let's say with rap, for example, I'm good at writing verses and I'm good at freestyling, but I'm terrible at production side of things. And, I don't know how to songwrite, like write a chorus. And so I'm hoping that my success in technology, you know, for example, Snoop Dogg wasn't answering my emails with my last company, but now he cares about technology. So I'm almost thinking, like, if I pass him, you know, we just got him featured on Product Hunt, maybe he'll get me on a verse or something. Like, this concept of trading value and kind of leveling up it by approaching it indirectly with what do these people care about? And then you build, even if I'm just really good at the verse part of it, or, you know, 16 bars or even freestyling, surrounding myself with all the best of production, the best of this, but that requires kind of a platform, which is either money or importance, or do you get what I'm saying?
Yeah, I get what you're saying. So for the sake of, you know, clarifying points, I'm going to be somewhat reductionist and contrarian here, right? So the sort of purest application of my theory would say, let's take rapping, for example, because this is something where, I have a good friend who went through this and I've spent a lot of time writing, and I've written some articles about him and his process of becoming a recording artist in the rap industry. I would say it's not the platforms that are important. It is the unambiguous skill, and everything else comes from that. So how does one deliberately develop a rap skill? It's actually very difficult. But what my friend ended up doing, he was in a similar situation. I mean, he was actually more of a course writer than a verse writer, but you know, was good at it and good at freestyling. And what he did to get to the next level was he actually he found a well-known club in Manhattan that had this weekly, it was called Showcase Open Mic Night, where you could you'd have to pay money and you could go on and perform with real people judging and the audience reaction, and there was prizes for the number one, you know, out of the night. And he said, well, this is just a really clear metric. I want to win this thing. So he goes and he performs and is doesn't do well. I mean, he doesn't have stage presence. His songs are not tight. And so he says, I'm just going to keep going back. And I have this clear feedback and I don't want to get, you know, booed. So I really got to stretch to try to be better next time. All right. You fast forward a few years later, he won the showcase. I think it was four times. The first person to ever do that, they retired him from it. You've won it too many times. You're not allowed to compete anymore. And now he's signed to like a great management label. Last time I talked to him, he was out at this recording studio in Malibu, you know, laying down tracks for a major album. But what happened in that example? It was all about my I have talent, but I don't have a skill that's unambiguously like you can't ignore it. So how can I, what's the most brutal stretching I could do? And there was really no more brutal stretching for him to go into this club in Manhattan and get in front of this really tough crowd with people from all the boroughs of Manhattan. And this is a small white guy from New Jersey, and go in front of this crowd. And you know what? He stepped up to those reps and got better fast. And you know, it worked out. So that's the purest answer is, a skill, unambiguous skill, is everything. So the question is, like, how could you be doing more reps than anyone else?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I'm also a small white guy from New Jersey, but we differ in that. I think we just have different goals. Let's just say his goal was to be kind of a conventional rapper, get signed by a label, make music. Whereas after thinking about it for a while, I really just wanted to, you know, have eight bars, drop a verse in other people's songs. I don't want a tour. I don't want to care about, you know, making money from music, because that's a hard business. I just really want to rap with people I admire. And then the other part of it is I want to be, you know, an amazing freestyle artist and build communities around that. And freestyling, you know, if you know because your friend's a rapper, isn't really a commercial skill the way writing choruses. Like, people don't really care how well, you know, Drake doesn't freestyle, for example. And so my goals didn't fit the conventional, like, does that make sense? We just have different goals.
Well, it does, but my devil's advocate would be, the term I use in the book is this notion of career capital, right? So the more rare and valuable skills you have, the more this career capital you have. And that's what you invest in, whatever it is you want to do with your career. And I think there's often a confusion that happens where it's mixed up. People mix up the notion of training to get good at something, a skill that's just unambiguously valuable, conventionally known as valuable, mixing that up with doing something conventional with your career. And that's not the way I see it. The way I see it is, if you get so good you can't be ignored at something, you have a bunch of career capital. And then what you do with that is up to you. I mean, you could invest it to have a recording touring career, or you could invest it by dropping in on people's tracks, like when you want and you're kind of in demand, or, you know, it's up to you what you do with the capital, but you have to have it before you can do those type of things. And really, it is unambiguous skill that is the surest way to build that capital. There's other ways to have it, right? I mean, it could be some sort of connection, or you're a celebrity otherwise, or, you know, I mean, if you're a movie star, you could probably drop a track on an album or something just because you know the guy from, you know, the clubs or something.
Yeah, I thought about it in this way, career capital, it's everything, because, you know, I actually, before this, I worked for Nas's venture firm for a little bit, Nas, famous rapper, and I thought about it in the context of, you know, no matter how good I was, or it might take a long time for me to get good enough for Nas to notice, I don't know, there are tons of people he doesn't notice, but I know that he particularly wants to fund startups, and I can pass him, and, you know, having a hot startup is like today's version of, and Product Hunt is a hot startup, is like career capital that all these people want to, it's, you know, unproven yet that'll get me on a track, but certainly, you know, enough to talk to me and enough to pass me beats and enough, does that make sense? You know, getting career capital through the startup. I don't know, feel free to push back.
Well, I mean, I guess where I push back is that, like, for example, if you know a lot about startups, you're connected to the startup scene, that gives you career capital that you could invest for things like, oh, I want to work with Nas on these type of projects or this or that. But if the goal is, you know, I want to have like a verse on a track or something like that, I mean, ultimately, it seems like the relevant capital there is going to, in the end, turn out being you're really good at that craft. I think there's some, this is the auction market, what you're talking about here, right? I mean, you could, if you're able to build up, like, I'm very conversant in this area of the recording industry, and I have a lot of skill in startups and technology entrepreneurship. The auction market might reward that by saying, yeah, you can work as like a venture capital consultant or as an angel investor advisor to Nas or someone and be in that world and do this really interesting stuff. And that's like the auction market at play. But the idea, I'd be more skeptical about the idea that you could use the auction market to get into a winner-take-all market. Right, and this is like the problem that happens in Hollywood a lot, that people that want to get into a winner take all market like screenwriting are trying to find other angles in. Well, what if I'm good with like technology and I have a good social media presence and this and that, and maybe I can slip in sideways to being a screenwriter? But that's the wrong market. You know, screenwriting is a winner take all market. People, these guys can read these scripts and know right away this is a bad script. And music is probably the same way. But investment within, say, you know, this particular segment of the recording industry or something, that could be something that's an auction market and that like you're incredibly valuable and well suited for.
Yes, I mean, it's interesting because I wonder as the, you know, the economy becomes more and more, I don't even know what the term is, but like people don't even write their own lyrics anymore. Like, you know, with enough of a career capital, enough of a platform, like, you know, you could have someone to write your lyrics, someone could even, you know, do everything but actually rap the words for you. And I'm using this as an example for even writing too. You know, people are ghostwriting for CEOs all the time. Like with a platform, and I wonder if that should be more of a focus, you can really, you know, satisfy all the weaknesses that will help, you know, in a winner-take-all market, or is that not the way to think about it?
I don't know that you can do that. And again, I'm being purist, but I mean, these winner-take-all markets, people in these markets have an incredible sense of discernment about the skill. And it's, you know, it's, yeah, you can get ghostwriter. You can hire these things to like ghostwrite a book, but that book is going to be just a fraction of the quality of a book that a really top tier, you know, nonfiction writer at the top of his game can produce and get paid a lot of money for. It's, you know, you it's not the same thing, right? I mean, it's just not going to be the same thing. Same thing with music. I mean, ultimately, like a world-class producer, you know, you can't, a world-class producer with a world-class lyricist, you know, and a world-class songwriter doing the hook, you know, I don't know. It's each of those people is at the very top of their field in a winner-take-all market. But I think recognizing that is really freeing. I mean, there's real pleasure in craftsmanship, and there's real pleasure in developing a craft and building a craft over time. And this is what skilled workers have done for millennia before the sort of more chaotic knowledge work age. So I'm partial to the winner-take-all market because it's brutal and it can be psychologically battering. But it also, there's a lot of clarity to it, and especially once you get a little bit of traction, there's just something nice in craft. Just like, hey, this is pretty good writing, and this guy's doing a lot better writing, and I'm a little bit closer to that than I was before. Kind of gives you a sense of fulfillment for that day of practicing.
Yeah, no, it's a very beautiful thing indeed. I think I wonder aloud whether, you know, it's, what I'm questioning for myself is, and I think a lot of entrepreneurs are in this place, is do you want to be A+ at something? Or do you want to be kind of A minus? Do you think that the world is maybe more of an auction market than one thinks, and A- at a bunch of stuff? Yeah, like, yeah, that, you know, the nonfiction book won't be an A+, but it'll still be a bestseller, you know, and then you'll be able to also interview people, and you'll also be able to do these types of stuff to, you know, kind of have more flexibility. Yeah. What do you think?
Well, I think that's a really good point. I call it it's known colloquially as the Matthew effect, and it's something I used to write about a lot. And I had a recent post about this that. If you do something really well, like typically for free, lots of really interesting related type opportunities come along, right? And where this shows up a lot, where I've written about it before, is studying the lives of star students. So like Rhodes Scholars at the college level, or students to get into like Ivy League colleges at the high school level. I wrote a book about them many years ago. And if you look at their resumes, you say, look at all these interesting things these people did. But then if you sit down and talk to them and meet them, what you find out is what they really did was one thing really, really well. And once they started getting really good at that, all of these cool opportunities kind of came along for free, and suddenly they got to do a lot more interesting things. So I am a big believer in that idea that if you take something and focus on it and get really good, it's not like you're going to spend all of your day writing. I mean, really good nonfiction writers end up getting to do lots of interesting things. I was talking to well, I guess I shouldn't use his name, he didn't give me permission, but he's a well-known general nonfiction writer. And he told me, he's like, this is one of the reasons what's been great about this job. He's a professor who also writes, is I now get to travel the world and like speak on these panels and go to different countries and stand on stage with other famous people. And what an incredibly valuable experience. He brings his wife with him for most of these trips and he loves it. Right. But, you know, he didn't set out to travel. He did the nonfiction writing really well. And then all these opportunities fell in his lap. So this type of thing tends to happen. You know, you focus on doing something unambiguously really well. And suddenly the diversity of high quality options open to you really expands.
Yeah. And in the business world, how would you describe someone like, you know, Mark Cuban or Dan Gilbert? Or, I don't know, some of these very successful businessmen, you know, what have they gotten so good at, or what's their... How do people become them, you know?
Well, Cuban's a good example, right? I mean, he was unambiguously successful at growing technology startup, right? I mean, broadcast.com was sold for a lot of money. Everything else interesting in his life came out of being, you know, doing that really successful. But I want to say a trend that I think is true and I think is relevant to you, if you don't mind me using you
as a case study.
I think the expanding world of knowledge work is opening up a lot of winner-take-all markets that are not well contested. So what I mean by that is if you want to become a world-class chess player, that is really, really hard because there's a lot of people who are dedicating their lives to be really good chess players, and it's going to be very hard to succeed at that. But I think the rapidly shifting economy, shifted by technology, is opening up lots of markets that are winner take all, but almost no one is approaching like a chess player approaches chess practice. So just to use you as a case study, you said one of the things you're interested in being really good at is interviewing. And I think, for example, in the podcast revolution going on right now, there's a lot of people who are focusing on doing a lot of podcast episodes, but you don't hear a lot about people who are actually trying to deliberately practice and aggressively and systematically improve their ability to interview. And so there's like a huge opportunity there. The few who do it could actually very quickly and massively have a quality of interview that's ahead of everyone else. There's this nice Tim Ferriss interview with the guy who does hardcore history, Dan Carlin, the Hardcore History podcast, which is a top 20 podcast on iTunes. And I remember in this interview, Tim was like, hey, this is so smooth. Like how much takes and how much editing do you have to do to get the episodes down so smooth? And Dan says, well, none. I basically do it in like one or two takes. and Tim, early on in his podcast, was kind of dumbfounded. He's like, I don't understand how you could possibly talk so smoothly and clearly for like 20 minutes without an edit cut. And Dan said, well, I was a professional broadcaster. Like I practiced this aggressively for like a decade. Like this was my career. Like I'm good at it because I really worked at it or something. And so in this example, there's like a lot of opportunity, I think, for people to become Dans because it's a winner-take-all market. But almost no one is contesting it with the same aggressiveness that, say, screenwriters or musicians or chess players are contesting their markets.
Well, let's analyze interviewing people. How does one, you know, besides doing it, you know, but how does one deliberately, you know, is it studying Charlie Rose and Mark Maron and Terry Gross? What does that look like, you know, clearly just seeing what they do and then repeating it and editing it and getting feedback and...
Yes. I mean, I think it's all those things. I mean, when I was really working on getting to become an idea book writer, I was dissecting Malcolm Gladwell. I was dissecting Clive Thompson. I was dissecting people whose writing was in a style that I admired. And I could, at the time, I could tell you the structure of a Malcolm Gladwell piece, like a professional musician could tell you the structure of a jazz piece. There's an A section, then you go to the B, and then you have to return to the A and look what he's doing with the language. And then I would sit down when I wrote my next article and try to take one of those skills and capture it in my article, the way he does profile, the way he does description, the way he does inversion. The same sort of thing could happen with interviews. What's Terry Gross doing here? Okay, let me identify this one thing she's doing really well. Look how she has this concision in the questions or this, and then waits. Let me try that on my next interview. You know, I don't know exactly what the exercises would be, but I don't think it's much more complicated than you really start to dissect what the good people do. You try to get brutal feedback from people who know what they're talking about. And every time you record something, I guess you would be trying to stretch some particular piece of it.
Yeah, no, that's great. And it's funny because I grew up in Charlie Rose. I've seen almost every episode. But since I started the podcast, I haven't been watching as much. And now is the time to look back and be like, hey, let's really dissect what they're doing.
Yeah, pacing, voice, concision. There's like all these elements that go in the professional broadcast. I mean, I know a little bit about this. My dad used to be a professional broadcaster. He's told me about this. There's so much training that goes into that that people don't know about. So I think this is true of a lot of things right now in the knowledge work economy.
Yeah. And we have a few episodes with some special tech guests that got picked up for SiriusXM. So we will be getting some more feedback.
It's fantastic. I mean, that's, yeah. And again, I'm just using this as a random case study. I don't know anything about interviewing, but I'm more and more convinced that there's a lot of winner take all markets that people aren't contesting that well right now.
What I wanted to ask you about with your mind, is actually freestyle rapping, because you know, if you look at the people who are really good at freestyling, they couldn't tell you how they're really good at it besides doing it a lot. Like, people aren't really scientific. So what I started doing, you know, the same way that guitar, you play guitar, and I don't play guitar, so maybe I'm using it incorrectly, but they have scales, right? These are like patterns so that when they're improvising, they can fall back on scales. I developed that with freestyling, and that I built up, I made kind of note cards for every single, you know, two-syllable, three-syllable, four-syllable rhyme combination. And said, I'm going to have at least two rhymes for each one, two stanzas, so that I could always fall back on something that's a hitter, that's a hit.
Yep.
And then I've also, what could I do to take it to the next level? And I thought, hey, I know Spanish. Maybe I can learn how to freestyle in Spanish by doing the same thing. And that could be really interesting. You know, how many people do you know that could do both? How am I thinking about that? / how would you think about it if you were trying to be, you know, if not the best freestyler, one of the most interesting freestylers, so good you can't be ignored in freestyling?
Well, what you're doing fits the first part of the pattern. So the deliberate practice pattern, there's this sort of breakdown and systemization piece, which is exactly what you're doing. You break down the broad skill into specific skills that add up to the broad skill being successful, so that you can take it apart and take particular pieces and stretch those pieces. So you're breaking down the broad skill of doing a successful delivery of a freestyle performance, and you're breaking it down into these sub things that add up to that, and you're tackling them one by one. So that's piece one. Piece two is then you find a way to stretch your current ability with each of those. So whatever piece you're working on, you're like, how do I get better at this? I don't know what it would be, but like increasing the repertoire of canned rhyme couplets or something like that. And then the third piece is brutal feedback that's expert, accurate, and honest. Which, like, for something in freestyling, if this is similar to like doing rap performance, for example, would probably mean you got to find competitions where like you probably wouldn't win it right now, but you're kind of close. And then win it. And then find a better competition. Where, like, I'm out of my league, but I'm not out of the orbit. And that's your feedback. I need to win this, you know. And so you're getting this brutal, honest feedback that's accurate and expert. So you're doing the first part, right? You're breaking it down. And now it's like, well, how can I stretch this thing? Like, if I want to increase my structure, let me have better structures and more sophisticated structures, right? Well, how can I make this if you say I have a double rhyme or whatever is a good fallback structure. Well, what if I had some sort of structure with a quadruple rhyme when one of them's a half rhyme, right? Like, I want it to be more complicated. My fallback structure is more complicated than anyone else on that stage. And how can my repertoire of rhyme, you know, rhyme words be deeper? I'm going to practice it. I have 50 at my disposal. Like, that's the notion of stretching the specific skill. And then you get up on stage and that's your feedback.
Do you think the language is a distraction, or like in Spanish or a different language, or is that adding to the repertoire?
I mean, I don't know that field very well. It feels a little bit like it might be a distraction. Like, it seems like the right thing is, you know, you have this analytical approach, which I think is exactly right and a huge advantage. I mean, you're really breaking it down. What matters, what adds up to a good freestyle performance. And then it's just taking these things and saying, okay, I could do this, but how could I do it five times better than that? Like, what would be the crazy place to go with this? Like, to really stretch myself on this, and that willingness to like take these components and then just stretch it past what other people are willing to do. Like, the, there's this famous professional marathoner. I think he was Greek. I'm not quite sure. Where he had this training where he ran something. It was like 8,400 meter sprints in a row. He just took a component that seemed important, and he would just do more of that than anyone else was doing. That type of compulsion to, once you understand the skill, to say, great, then I'm going to take this component and here's what would make me really good. Let me do five times that. Shows up a lot in people that become real masters.
And it's interesting, you know, I started wanting to be, or grew up wanting to be an amazing basketball player, but like chess, for some reason, like, it's really hard. Like, a lot of it seems to rely on natural, you know, strength and size and ability. And, you know, you could get really good, but to be the best in the world, like, you know, how are you going to compete with, like, LeBron James, you know what I mean? But yep. And even you know, make rap music, like some of the, you know, you need to have a voice, you need to, like, there's a lot of things that seem to be natural, and freestyle too, to be sure, but it just seemed that, for example, to have, to be able to go forever, like, that's a skill that one could really cultivate. Does that make sense? Like, picking fields, as you mentioned earlier, that either there's not a ton of competition, or that, you know, there aren't huge natural barriers, perhaps?
Yeah, I think that's a good way of looking at it. This is what's exciting about the current technology-driven knowledge work economy, is that it's opening up more uncontested fields or lightly contested fields, because what you said is absolutely true. There's a lot of fields out there now that if you don't have the right starting conditions, it's going to be incredibly hard. So I think people can get to like expert level in things and almost anything, right? But to be the very best of the best, there's a lot of fields where there's going to be a natural component that's hard to overcome. And athletics is very clear, right? If you're 6'10", you're 6'10". I mean, I can't practice myself to be 6'10" as a basketball player. But music, there's a lot of this voice, you know, just the shape of, you know, with rap, I know a lot of it is your voice and just the mouth shape, your ability to articulate and crispness and delivery. Like, some of that stuff you can't do anything about. So I think that really plays a big role. But sometimes it plays too big of a role. You know, like, I used to be incredibly intimidated by mathematics, and I've increasingly come to believe that there's less natural mathematics ability than people suspect. And there's just a lot more stealth training happening than people recognize in the people who are really good at it. So I don't want to be too intimidated by it. But, you know, I think it's a smart thing to keep in mind. You know, things where it's clear that there's natural abilities that matter and you don't have them, you probably don't want to invest that much time in.
And that's what I've been wondering with rap, for example. Like, can I, you know, improve my voice significantly, which would change, or is that something that's a bit more natural? And is the only, you know, do you have any answers to that, or how do you even find out?
I mean, I don't know the answer for rap, but I mean, it's an interesting question. It's an interesting question to ask. I mean, if I had to guess, I would say no, that's overcomable. It's not basketball or something. Like, in basketball, if you read like the sports scene, it's not even height, it's actually the like ratio of your arm length. The height is everything, like your ability to have long reach, and it's very hard to overcome. But in rap, there's way more flexibility in what defines success. You know, you could have an interesting voice that's maybe not great, but if there's something about your lyrics or your hooks or something. So I think that's probably, that field is probably auction marketable in sort of what combination of rap skills add up to a successful rapper, that there's more flexibility than, say, basketball or chess. I think chess really has a neural wiring component to it.
Yeah, it's interesting. So as the book released 3 years ago, or almost 3 years ago, how, you know, what have you been thinking most about, besides, you know, obviously your deliberate practice in two fields? I guess I'm asking, what's your next book?
So the next book is Deep Work. And it's actually, I'm done writing it. It's going to come out in January. The same publisher, Hache. And the premise of the book is that it looks at this skill called deep work, which is the ability to focus without distraction on a cognitively demanding task. So the ability to really just lock in on something that's mentally very demanding and give it your full mental energy. And the argument of the book is that this skill is becoming more valuable in our economy right now. That there's a lot of different factors that's making this a very in-demand skill, at the same time that it's becoming more rare, just because there's a rise in distractions, you know, things that can distract us. So people are actually getting worse at doing deep work just as it's becoming more broadly important. So my argument is that it's going to be a tier one skill in the economy. That if you're one of the few who actually cultivates that skill, just like you might cultivate the ability to write or computer program, you can be a star in the economy. So I make that argument, and then I really get into the nitty gritty of how do people become better at doing deep work.
Yeah, that's exciting. And what are some of the biggest, you know, principles of how people can get better at deep work, just to give a preview?
Yeah, well, the four big ideas, the first big idea is work deeply. So how you actually just structure when you work, where you work, how you work, your rituals surrounding doing your work, your rules while you actually do the work, no internet, these type of things. All these things matter to set the environment right, the way you schedule your time and block time off for doing deep work. So that's sort of, that matters. You have to set things up to be conducive to deep work. Then the next big idea is I call it embrace boredom. Which is basically you have to start training your mind to be able to concentrate and to be content with being bored. Because deep work is boring in the sense that it doesn't give you a lot of novel stimuli. So you have to start training your mind just like you would train your lungs to be a runner, to be able to actually focus and concentrate and not have to see a retweet or a Facebook or an Instagram post every 5 minutes. So that's a training thing. You have to train. The third of four ideas, provocatively, I call the chapter Quit Social Media. And what I really mean by it is you have to become way more selective about what things you let have access to your time and attention. And for someone who's very serious about deep work, that probably means you're going to have a lot less network tools in your life. I don't use any social media, and that's very important to my ability to foster my deep work capabilities. And then the final notion, I call it drain the shallows. I think it's important to really attack the non-deep stuff that's in your life and be very aggressive by minimizing how much of that stuff is in your life and then corralling what's left. How do you handle email? How do you organize your tasks? These type of things are really important because you have to keep the non-deep work, what I call shallow work, under control, or you're just not going to have any time or energy left to do the deep stuff. So those are my four big points.
Awesome. And I have a question for you. I think we'll close with this or with this concept. You've thought a lot about what's important when getting good at a skill or a job or now in the last few years, do you have two kids or one kid?
Two kids.
You've become a father. You've married. Are there parallels to the concept of do the thing that deliberate practice, but in friendships or relationships, or is that totally different world completely that operates on? How have you thought about relationships and being a father in those contexts or in your life?
Well, these are definitely fields where I'm still an amateur needing to learn from the experts. But I think there's an element of that in it. There's an element in the sense that anything that's important is hard. I guess that's sort of the takeaway I've learned from the first 30 odd some years of my life is like, oh, okay, everything important is like really hard. And that's not a bad thing. It just changes your mindset. Like, okay, you want to have an interesting career. Like, it's really hard to get good at something. Like, you want to have a strong family. Like, you got to really work. It takes work and effort and attention. And it's not always easy. And just learning to be comfortable of things being hard and hardness. And that's kind of a feeling of being alive, struggling to get something, getting better at something, tackling something that was hard to do. That seems to pervade everything in my life I find important. So, the most important thing is my family. It's hard work to run a family, but very fulfilling. Second most important thing. Well, some of these career things, my writing, my computer science, it's really hard. I mean, I talk about how people systematically get good, but the reason why I'm not the very best at these things, there's people who are much better, even though I think about this a lot, is just that it's really hard. And some people are just working harder at it than I am. And I'm okay with that. I actually respect it. And I'm trying and they're trying harder. And so that's like the motto I kind of come away with. Everything important is hard. And that's not a bad thing to recognize. I guess that's the theme. I would be a terrible commencement speech.
I was just about to ask, what would you tell your 22-year-old self in 2015? Is that it?
Everything is hard, but doing hard things is exciting. But that means you need to get started right away and keep your eye on the prize because it's not easy. You can't just decide to do something 20 years from now. It just comes along. So choose a couple things, start doing the hard work, enjoy it while you do it.
Yeah. Not as flashy of a commencement speech, but certainly, more impactful.
Yeah, I hope so.
Well, you'll make it flashy when the time comes. I know. is there another book underway too? You've already written this one. Do you know what the next one is going to be about?
I don't know yet. So, my method is that I write articles, I write blog posts, and I see what emerges as interesting to my audience and interesting to me and potentially impactful. And once something emerges, then I do a book. So deep work, I mean, so good they can't ignore you. That theme just, I was writing for students at the time years ago. And this notion of the role that passion was playing in their lives as they were trying to choose their major and trying to choose their jobs, I was noticing, like, what's this passion stuff? It seems to be tripping people up. And that drove a transformation in my writing away from the student space and towards this more general space. And then after I was working on that book, the role of deep work kind of came up in that book. And as I was writing about it, it seemed to take over my blog and take over my article writing for a while. And people really were responding to that book came out of it. So right now, that's where I am. I don't know what's going to emerge next. So it'll be exciting to see. And if someone has an idea, a hot topic, a very important topic that people aren't talking about, let me know.
Awesome. I have a couple predictions. One, this I think there will be communities of people who say, how do we encourage each other to pursue deep work? How do we create environments, maybe it's living situations, maybe it's working situations? And what does a deep work world look like, and how do we push each other? That's one. And another is, as you become a parent, maybe you have another kid, like, what is, maybe some of these principles will bleed into family building or community building in general?
Yeah. Well, we'll see. I mean, as to the first one, I think you're absolutely right. And I think specifically here's my two predictions for the future. One, I think we're going to see more Facebook quitting. Not that like there's something particularly terrible about Facebook, but I think as like making a stance and an internal psychological commitment towards, focusing on things that matter, that's like a really visible kind of somewhat easy to do, but actually kind of subversive thing. So I think Facebook quitting is going to become the sort of mark of someone joining the deep work movement. So that's my one prediction. And the second is I think there's going to be a rethinking of email at some point in the next 10 years. I don't think it's going to last much longer in the way it currently is, which is just an undifferentiated box that everyone has access to and everyone has expectations of responses. And I don't know quite what the replacement necessarily is going to be. It might be a technological replacement. But my prediction is we might start to see things like essentially email assistance rising, where communication comes to people whose whole job in the company is to monitor incoming communication, keep up with it, and then come at less regular intervals and talk to individual people and say, okay, here's the things, let me come by this morning and tell you, here's the different things that are on your plate. There's these five people need responses. You really need to handle these. I got rid of this stuff. And that this notion that everyone is their own assistant plus doing whatever skilled work they do, I think that's going to disappear as well. So I'm just taking wild predictions, but those are my two ones: Facebook quitting and a transformative, approach to the role that digital communication plays in the workplace.
No, absolutely. And it's happening a little bit with some startups that are trying to kind of use artificial intelligence to be assistants and filter, and serve as one as a filter so they can kindly reject people, and two, show what's important.
Yeah. But, hey, we have really good, and we don't need artificial, we have really good intelligence. That's the way it was until about 20 years ago. So I think that old trend will come back. Like, well, why don't we just have someone whose whole job is the monitoring, and then everyone's expectations will change. They're like, oh yeah, I don't have direct access to the time and intention of this executive. I have access to the person who does the digital communications for that department in the office. So I don't expect like an immediate reply, and I might not get any reply, but I know it'll be seen. I know it'll be evaluated. And if it is relevant, the proper things will happen. I think people will be satisfied with that.
Yeah. The etiquette will definitely change, and we'll be a lot happier. So thank you, Cal. And hopefully I'll be there with you off Facebook. I need to be it for this one, but maybe in the future. Thanks for, I've been following your stuff maybe, 6 years now. Been a big fan, and it's really influenced my life. So thank you for doing what you do. I'm excited to read Deep Work. So Good's going to be on Product Hunt. So is Deep Work once it launches. And thanks for the advice, Cal. It means a lot.
Yeah, well, thanks, Eric. I love what you're doing with Product Hunt, and it's great after so many years of digital communication to actually get a chance to sort of talk one-on-one.
Absolutely. Thanks, Cal. Have a great day and many deliberate practice to come.
Yeah, back to work.
Absolutely. Have a good one, Cal.